Hello, welcome to episode 41 of Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is an episode about landscape in fiction because I am returning to Thrush Cross in the Becca book, and all it's making me think of is the way good authors use landscapes well and bad authors maybe not so much, or people who it's just not their strength, you know, like I'm not saying anybody's a bad author, but some people use landscape really, really well and some don't. And I noticed, for example, Summerlands, I don't think I use landscape well. And that was part of the problem of it. Like, there's the house. Yeah, we got the house. There's the grounds. Okay. There's a hotel. There's a lake down the hill. But it was just there. It wasn't part of the story the way it should have been. And of course, there's always regrets about anything you write. Things that could have been better, but that's one that's been bothering me. I know I didn't use landscape well. And as I'm I'm sorry to laugh. It almost feels like fan fiction going back to Thrush Cross. but as I'm returning there, this is a landscape I know, and it has, in the first Thrush Cross novel, it had so much importance, like where things were and what happened, and everything was landscape dependent. And I'm just last night starting to write the part where Becca goes there for her internship with this show she's in love with and has all of her Battlestar trauma. She hasn't had it yet. Poor Becca doesn't know what's in store for her. But I'm realizing that the landscape has to play a part. And I did a wacky thing. I did a wacky thing where I gave Becca's history a location that puts her right there. Okay, so her drug dealing, hippie commune, meth manufacturing family was squatting. And this is a little bit adapted from Gloria O'Brien. I mean, I got the idea there. They were squatting there in a bunch of trailer campers, like not RVs, but just, trailers that you would tow behind your truck. So they're just there. They can't up and leave. You have to tow it with something. So they're there manufacturing meth in some kind of like mobile home that's stuck in the woods. And the kids are told to get away all day long. And so the kids are out there. And this is, it reminded me so much. It's so weird. Reminded me so much of Thrush Cross, where you've got Harriet and sometimes Isaiah as little kids just out running around in the woods. And some kids do this. A lot of us in the 70s were just out and about. You know, nobody was watching us. We were just out. We went all over the place and did all kinds of things that now kids would never do, but some kids would. But I tend to write these kids out in the woods, you know, like on their own, doing their own thing. And these kids, so little Becca and her friend Shay, they were the youngest ones, and all the older kids were out like on their bikes or skateboards or whatever, doing deliveries. And the older kids who could drive would drive and do deliveries. So the parents stayed home and the kids went out and took stuff places, and then everybody got. And this is the wacky thing. This is what ties it back in, because when the property was surveyed to be sold, they discovered the commune camp out there and everybody got evicted. Police had to come in, I guess the sheriff. So it was Uncle Steve, came in and had to clear it out. And a lot of them got arrested. And it was a massive operation. So they ended up in federal prison. And Becca and Shay were out in the woods and did not get taken in with everybody else, so they were left behind. And so once again, I've got abandoned children in the woods, which I don't know why that's a theme. I was never abandoned in the woods. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the woods, but like had a home to go to and people who put food on the table. So I don't know. Anyway, I've got this going on again. But the thing is, having that family evicted, or I mean, not evicted, they weren't renters, they were squatters. Having them removed ruined Becca's life, or saved Becca's life, because she would have grown up to be delivering drugs for her meth dealing parents. You know what I mean? Like, that's not great. But it set her life in motion, and she finds it out on her first morning on the internship when Cole explains to her what happened to that camp that was out there. So, and also like, hi, you know, your heroes here, they're the ones who did this to you. Oh, yeah, and my husband is the sheriff. Okay, so I've just done this terrible thing to Becca. Sorry, Becca. Becca gets all the terrible things. But she's also going to have the terrible Battlestar experience of, not terrible, she gets to meet everyone. It changes everything, you know? and I'm busy populating it with like Bluminek from from Tumblr, who's actually, I think, on YouTube, who's this amazing archer and sword person. Like, he can use all these different, he's so agile and fit, and he can do stuff like go up a pole, you know, a pole like dancers go on. He can go up, and he does a lot of like modeling for people who need reference shots for like drawing graphic novels and things like that. So he'll do stuff like go up this pole and shoot his bow upside down and hit the target. Like, he does these amazing shots. One day he went and got all these high heels and tried doing in all these high heels. Like, he's just really cool. Anyway, I'm stealing him for a character. Sorry. I'll send him a book. That's what I do. And then there's somebody else I wanted to add. Oh, I wanted to add Murderbot as security. Only a human veteran who's all grumpy and really tired of everybody being an idiot. So I'm adding a Murderbot security guy. I have to people this place. Time has passed. It's just very weird to return to your own fictional world and realize, oh, 5 years has passed. And because I'm doing it all in real time, I wrote that in 2020, right? So Harriet's 5 years older than Becca. So Becca was, you know, Harriet's 18, buying this place. Becca's out there 13, you know? Isn't it weird? But I just feel like things run in real time, which they don't. Anything can be anywhere, anytime. Anyway, so landscape was my point. So I'm rereading Joan Aiken's Whispering Mountain. Is it called Whispering Mountain? I have 3 copies of this book. I love this book. I would carry this book around with me if I guess I could. It's so good, and it's so very, very landscape-based that you need to read it to understand exactly how landscape-based it is. And it was one of my very first favorite books of hers, and I love her books. I believe I have them all. Do I have them all? I might not have the later ones, like short story collections and things, but I have all the novels for sure, and I adore her books, and this is my favorite of them. In a lot of ways, although also A Cluster of Separate Sparks is probably, might edge ahead because I've read that many more times. But they are equally landscape-based, okay? So A Cluster of Separate Sparks, there's this hill, mountain, little mountain, with a castle on top. A crusader castle, it was a castle before that. It was a, you know, it was like a, there's temples up there. So it was it's an ancient site, and it's been reused and reused and reused over the centuries. And it's just so vivid, and there's all these places in it. There's Professor Furgard's area, and there's the hospital with the sick kids, and there's, you know, Mr. Capranus's study and his various living spaces. The bathroom alone, the bathroom where he's reclining like a strawberry in a bathtub, and it's all like sea green foam, and you know, the tiles, like, you can see this, you can see all of it, you can see the room where she plays the organ, you can see every bit of it. And there's a similar thing to the landscape there as there is to Whispering Mountain. They're very similar. They have a lot of overlap in terms of, like, there's tunnels and there's a mountain with a castle on top, and there's the seaside village, and like, it's very, very similar. So I'm thinking about how you use landscape, because she uses landscape in Whispering Mountain so well that every single thing that happens, it's important where it happens, and where it happens determines how it happens. And people have to traverse this sort of like 40-mile distance across a mountainside, sorry, I can't breathe today, to get from one place to the other. And there's Erebus and her father in their caravan, and the horse, Galahad. And like, they have to travel places to do things. They have to go up to, little Owen has to go up to the castle to see this terrifying Lord Malin, who wears all gold. He's really obsessed with gold, and everything he has is yellow. He has, like, he only eats peaches and yellow things. Like, curry, everything's yellow. He's obsessed with yellow. I love him as a character. He's sort of he's the villain, but he's such a cool character. Like, how do you think of that? Like, this guy has everything all yellow. So Owen Hughes has to travel all around, and he has to overcome all these obstacles, and the bad guys kidnap him, stick him in these houses that are on the edge of the cliff that are abandoned because the hillside's going to come down on them, which, guess what, later on it does. But they tie him up and leave him there, but Erebus finds him. Like, She has a hawk who, and he has trained the hawk to come when he whistles a song. And even though they've muffled, what is it called? Gagged. They've gagged him. He manages to sing it through his nose, like hum it through his nose, which is like cool. And the hawk finds him and brings Erebus, and she saves him. And they go and they look in all these caves because the harp has been stolen. Anyway, it's so landscape based. When a story is so very landscape based, I find it incredibly compelling because if the writer is good, and she is the best, you see it all. You see it and you're there. Like you're climbing a mountain. He has to climb up a tree. There are boars and there are wolves and there are all of these obstacles. And there are these boys who are beating him up. When you first meet Owen, it's because these boys are beating him up. They're chasing him after school to beat him up. They're thugs, right? They're these awful boys. And he ends up going on a trip with them, trying to go get the. Trying to go up to Lord Mallon's castle. But there are these terrible boys who are against him, and then he gradually wins them over one by one by overcoming all of these sort of like Boy Scout obstacles. Like he knows which creeper to use to swing across the gorge when the path has been destroyed. And then when the flood comes, he knows how to get them up the tree and he knows when to jump down. And like he knows stuff. He's good at physical survival stuff, even though he's like a skinny bookish boy with glasses, right? So they don't respect him. But he knows stuff, and so they do respect him. And the boys gradually get picked off one by one. Like they bail and go home one by one. And they're like, nope, I'm not climbing that. I'm out. I'm going back home. And so he gets there, but he gets there with not as many as when he started. Oh boy, the landscape is so vivid. They get washed out of the river once they jump into it from the flood and get washed up on this spit of land. So it's an adventure. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. An adventure has landscapes in it. And a book ought to be an adventure. I really think every book should be an adventure. Like you should be getting out of your comfort zone. That's like thing number one in a book, is a character has to get out of their comfort zone, I think, and go into a new situation and have to learn it and navigate it and overcome the obstacles and figure it out. And if that can be landscape, why do I keep saying landscaped? Landscape based, that's infinitely better because it takes an internal journey and makes it external, right? Like this is what worked so well in Thrushcross. She was dealing with all of these internal issues, but they were all external. Externalized. Even the treasure that she hid all over the property and then went and got. Like that, I just made it up as I was going along, but it was so cool the way it came out. I don't know how not to take credit for something that I did actually write, but I don't know if I should get credit because I figured it out after the fact. It's really like someone threw a whole bunch of quilt squares at me, and I was like, I don't know this. And then, oh, that one doesn't go there. Take that out and fix this and do this again and rework it until it makes sense, because that's how I write books. So the whole thing with Becca having an internship is added after the fact. Like I had never imagined this when I first imagined the story. Not at all. It was Becca going to college and having to overcome being obsessed with this TV show, like escaping reality into this TV show. And people do this, of course. People find an online fandom or they get obsessed with a show and just sort of live there. It's a good way to escape reality. And so that was the story. She does this and then she has to learn how to live in the real world instead. Ta-da! And then added on having those sort of episodes where she zones out, like the absence thing. I don't know if I want to call it absence seizure. Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, her thing. I don't really want to diagnose my character. I looked up all the different things it could be and I'm like, eh. She just does this thing. She just disappears for a while. And it's not under her own volition, and she can't get out of it under her own volition. She just like she just disappears. It's just extreme, not daydreaming, but just going. It's almost like putting yourself into a trance and going into a trance state. But it doesn't happen by choice and it doesn't end by choice. So I don't know what you want to call it. It needs it. She calls it zoning out, but it's bad enough that it completely disrupts her life and it, you know, she has to have accommodations at school so that people know, like, oh, she's not just not paying attention. She's actually having a psychological thing happen to her. So anyway, that's Becca's zoning out thing. So that's added on. Now she's not just obsessing about a show and escaping that way. She's like absolutely disappearing from the planet when she goes into these space outs. And now she has to go into the world where her show is being made and deal with the fact that this is a real thing with, like, W-2s. Like, she has to fill out a W-2 because she's a paid intern. I cannot stop fidgeting. I'm really sorry. Yeah, she has to fill out forms because she's a, is it an I-9 or whatever? She has to fill out forms because she's a paid intern, and she has to have a parking thing. You know, like, she has to have a transponder to get onto the lot through the gate. She needs this pass. She has to have wear a badge, you know, like it was her fantasy escape. And now it's this prosaic reality and the actors are just actors. And maybe I have to give a name to the Blumenek guy. I don't remember his actual name. If I think one up, it'll probably be his real name. So I can't give him that. I'll have to look it up and find out what his real name is and make sure not to use that. You know, she has to meet this guy who's like, he's their weapons expert, but he's also, he plays a character in the show. And I'm suddenly deciding that's the character she's really obsessed with. That's the one she thinks is the coolest. So there, she's going to meet him and he's just going to be a guy. It's so weird when that happens, when you're like, this is a whole person, like a fictional person in a book or something. You can see all of these parts of their lives and you're inside their head and there's all this stuff and they belong to you in a certain way, and then you also belong to them in a certain way. And then if you meet the real human who plays that person on TV, it explodes your brain. It really does weird things to you. It's very, very strange. And I suppose it's much worse if, like me and Becca, you have extreme suspension of disbelief, which she does and I do, because then, you know, you've suspended disbelief. You're like, yeah, I'm on a spaceship with these people. This is a spaceship, and outside is vacuum, and there's flying robots coming after us. It sounds so stupid, but if you believe in it, you believe in it. And I think the magic of the show is what they're after. So they're not like, man, how dumb that you believe in it. They're like, good, it worked, you know, good. We did it right. We did a good job. And so they think it's cool, but also, yeah, you got to dial it back a bit, Becca. She's not loud or anything, but she's just like big eyes, you know, big eyes. Wow. Like, I'm sure I was cooler than that, I hope. I know I was, but she's not. She's very young and she's quite traumatized and she's overwhelmed and she's not going to be super cool. She might freak out a bit. She's probably the kind of person, I can make up any kind of person, who if she gets overwhelmed will just start having tears run down her face. I used to have this dry eye issue where my left eye would cry all the time. And people would be like, oh no, are you okay? And I'm like, it's just my eye. it's a visceral thing for people when they see someone crying. Like they want to take care of you and stuff. And it was constantly embarrassing, but just like the drainage duct or something wasn't working right. And so my left eye would just, especially if I got upset or stressed, it would just start to weep. I think you produce more tears or something when you're upset. And I don't mean like running down the face. I mean, just like staying in the eye. So I think that would happen. And then all of a sudden there would be my left eye crying. I had almost forgotten about it because it hasn't happened in years. Thank goodness. Because what a pain that was. Thank you for being fixed, eye. So anyway, she should have visual cues that say I'm overwhelmed and upset, because she's very stoic and very internal. And but you know, you have these external things people can see, like freaking fidgeting. Stop it. I can't stop fidgeting today. I don't know what my deal is. Shaking all over. All right, so that's landscape. It's not a good landscape based story. We'll use the landscape to reflect what's going on with the character, or vice versa, right? It's an external way to show the character. It's important to the character, the way the landscape works. So I'm putting this character into a landscape that is incredibly familiar to her because she's seen the show a million times. She's obsessed with it. So she's seen these places. She's seen the woods of Thrushcross in her TV show that she loves and watches over and over and uses as a psychological escape from her troubling life, right? So she comes here to Thrushcross, which, by the way, I was up at work, which is up near, this is going to sound so ludicrous, it's near where Thrushcross is. It does not exist. There's a big stretch of open land. It's actually not mountainy enough to be, it doesn't matter also because it's fictional, but there's this big section of land. And if you ever want to look at a map, it's by LaGrange, east of LaGrange. That's where I put Thrushcross in my mind. And it's so weird to drive up north and be at work and be like, oh, it's right over there. Because it's not. It's really super not. It's not. And I even thought about driving around over there. And I'm like, why? Why? It's not like I based it on that. I don't think I've ever been over there. So I just put it there because it's near things I need it to be near. But, like, I'm having landscape issues. I'm having landscape and reality issues, just like Becca. So, poor Becca. So, anyway, the Whispering Mountain. Yeah. How can I ever do anything that good? I wonder, like, I could maybe draw a map of Thrushcross. I'd have to read it again because I get things mixed up in my mind, partly because I don't think I ever really clarified them. Like, I know you can walk to the school. And you can walk, no, you can't walk to the school from their house. You can walk to the daycare. That's what it is. You can walk to the daycare, but it's a long way and it's up a long steep hill and then downhill on the way back. But you can't, you could, I suppose, but there's that river in the middle, the one she fell in. That's why she lived with her uncle, because then you could walk to the school from there. So tricky, right? So like I know generally the landscape of it, but again, yeah, I'd have to read the book to draw a map. And I'm starting to think I should draw a map. Or here's another idea, two maps. One that shows the actual landscape and one that shows the show landscape, right? The landscape of the show that she knows in her mind, but she can gradually start to map like, oh, when we're on the planet, whatever, it's this part. Like how Caprica, and what's that other, is it Cobol? Did they go to Cobol? They look like the woods outside Vancouver, which is like what every sci-fi TV show looks like. You go on Stargate and they're like, oh, it's, wow, weird. Same woods, huh? Pacific Northwest woods. Yep, there they are. So this is all Maine woods, but it's, you know, whatever. It's the Atlantic Northeast. So that she knows what they look like in the show. And then to be like, I just think I really want to blow her mind with this. And I never went on any sets or anything, not of a show I saw. I mean, I saw a bunch of sets for other things, and there was the set for Pushing Daisies that my friend and I got obsessed with, or rather I got obsessed with, because I loved Pushing Daisies. And we used to go see the pie. There was the big pie set, you know, and the guard, we would come by and like peek in if the door, and the guard one time was like, you want to go see? Go ahead. Because I think we just looked like two harmless doofuses, you know, and we were wearing our badges and all. So he knew we were official, and he let us go in and see the pie. And it was the greatest day of my... No, it wasn't. But it was really fun, and it was really cool to see the actual pie set. And it's dumb on one level because, you know, if it's a TV show, there's sets. You know they exist. We know this. We've seen them on TV. But then to go there and see it and be like, there's all the lamps that look like cherries, and, like, here's the pie crust roof, like... It just is cool and weird. It's weird. Like, you can't go to the set where my books are shot. Well, you kind of can. I kind of work there now where they go sometimes. It's just so weird because it was fictional first and now it's real. What is happening? But, like, yeah, you can't go to Thrushcross. You can't. It's not there. There's no studio there. There's not. No, I was just like, wait, what if someday? I don't think that's going to happen on a nice piece of boggy scrub up there. But maybe. I mean, anything can happen. I got to see the pie. Anything can happen. And then we'd go around singing, at least again, I would, my poor friend Anne. You know the song, I Saw the Sign? I would sing it, I Saw the Pie. Oh, no. And we'd walk around the lot, and I was so excited by everything all the time. It was really fun to be me back then. Like, everything was exciting and fun. I was just reading this spot where we we saw one of those "Your speed is" signs, and it would register the speed of the cars coming toward it to tell you to slow down. And she was laughing so hard because I saw it, and I started running toward it as fast as I could, and it registered 7 miles an hour. And I was like, I don't think so. But yay! Just like, who does that? Why did I do that? I live in this weird whimsical world, I guess. Or I used to. Anyway, now I write books. It is a little tricky when your reality and your fiction collide. And I guess that's partly what I'm talking about with like going there, going to Thrush Cross. And that tour I did that day last week or whenever, when my landlord was putting a new roof on and the noise was making me insane. He did it for like 2 hours a day for 2 weeks. Every time I came home, he wouldn't do it in the morning when I was out. No, I guess you want the roof to be dry. He would do it in the afternoon when I was home. And just like, it was making me crazy. So I put the dog and the cat in the car, put the cat in her soft carrier that I got for the puppy, soft crate. And we went in the car and the kitty yelled the whole time. And I ended up driving, just kind of by accident, a loop of, because I meant to take them to Acadia. I was going to take my cat to Acadia and my dog. And then I was like, wait, what if she claws through the soft crate? And then what? My cat is loose in Acadia? That can't happen. Also, I couldn't find my pass. So I didn't. So we just went to Ellsworth and back, and we made a loop of all the locations that are in Summerlands, sort of coincidentally. Like, there's the gas station where she worked, and there's the road down to the... I'm not going down that road. It's all muddy. Down to the house on the lake, which is where I set the cabins, and there's the Lucerne Hotel, which is what I used for the house in Summerlands, basically. The big house. I sort of split it up into a house and a hotel. And all of these locations that were just like in this book. And I was driving by and I'm like, look, there it is. Just so weird. Because it was there first. And then I wrote the book. It's also not it. You know what I mean? But it's like one of those Stephen King tours where they drive tourists all around and show them all the spots that are inspirations or that appeared in his books. So I went on one of my tours of all my spots. So now you can add the university and you can add the land east of LaGrange that turned into Thrush Cross. It's getting a little trippy in here, I gotta tell you. And I do feel like giving that to Becca is a really good way to go, but... Her landscapes have to be so important to her. Like, and how embarrassing and weird would it be? And I know I went to see the pie, but there was no one but Anne there to see me see the pie. Also, the pie was not like, it wasn't like I was seeing, you know, the Battlestar Galactica sets or anything. I never saw any of that. But like, just seeing the pie freaked me out so much. So for her, it would be like if I went to the Battlestar sets. Like, if you know this place so thoroughly and you know all of these stories and everything connected to it, and it's been so important, it's been literally the place where she's been hiding for 5 years, maybe four, because I don't know when they started shooting that show. Oh no, must have been like January of the next year, 2021. So she's been watching it for 4 years and obsessing over it. And then she gets to go and be there. And it's just, and it was her obsession over it that got her the internship, because she made all these little movies and they were like, you're doing some high level work here. Like, she did stuff like imitate the directing choices so that they could actually see. She didn't do it for them. She just did it. But when they saw them, they could see, you know, oh, you're imitating. And she would do shot for shot remakes and things like that, you know, like she would do stuff that's insidery stuff for people who are obsessed with that show that does not exist. So that got her the internship that got her to the place where the show happened. And it's going to blow her mind. It's going to cause some issues for poor Becca. And I know I have to do this to her, but I feel really bad about it. Oh no, she's fictional. It's okay. Slight pause for a barking festival. They are intermittent here. Oh, still ongoing, apparently. Yep. So landscape in The Whispering Mountain is something that is so important to the story that it could not be the same story set somewhere else. And I think that's part of what makes a landscape-based story really good is that it has to be there. It can't be anywhere else. Come to think of it, I did this in Landslide also. It had to be there. It had to be near this ski resort. It had to be near the Appalachian Trail. It had to be that one spot. It's why I drove up to whatever the name of that town is. I keep thinking Esker, but that's in the Thrushcross books. And all the other books, Criminy, everything's set in the same area. I need to get on the road and go somewhere else once in a while, which I never, ever do. Even when I went on the road that day, I went to all familiar spots. It's not cool. I used to go different places when I would go get furniture, but I haven't done that. For one thing, there's enough furniture. For another thing, there's not enough space. Please, no, make a lot of noise. Good girl. So, landscape, it has to be there. And I guess that's where going to Thrushcross is important. It has to be there for Becca to have her meltdown. And it wasn't originally. Originally, she was just going to go there and meet, because she made the show and they liked the show. She was going to go there and meet people and sort of get a job and get out of the town where all these things happened and get away. And then putting the show there made it 10 million times better. For one thing, of course you'd be into a show that's getting shot right nearby. Of course you'd be curious about that and want to know about it. If you're in rural Maine and somebody's shooting a TV show nearby, you're going to be curious, you're going to watch it, and then you might get super into it because it looks like home. How cool is that? It might be a little destructive to the suspension of disbelief if it looks like home, but on the other hand, it might just make it look normal. So I guess it could do that. Yeah, the landscape has to be essential to it. I'm trying to think of other books. Oh no, all the Thrushcross books are absolutely landscape dependent. Like the one where she goes to LA, it's all of these very specific locations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then Summerlands, kinda. The thing is, that could be anywhere, except it is her historic family location. So that matters. Yeah, nope, that has to be there. It has to be there. And she has to come back there. There's something very upsetting about having to return to the site of your terrible previous experiences. Like, I don't know, a lot of people aren't as landscape oriented as I am, but, and I've said this before, I'm sure, but like, I remember events attached to spots. And so driving around Bangor is terrible because I remember this person I dropped off and this person I picked up and the conversation I had right here and when I gave that little girl a bunny up there by her daycare, you know, like I remember everything from the spot. So every time I pass the spot, there's that memory right there, locationally based. It's almost like a pop-up. Like I drive over it and it goes, boop, there's this little, oh, you're having a memory now. Every time you drive by the spot, you're going to have this memory. Great. Even in like Habitat for Humanity, which I go to every once in a while. I only got a pry bar this last time. I needed a new pry bar. My old one bent. It bent. That was a piece of crap pry bar. Low quality. So like I go in there and I remember where the chairs were when I got them, even though that was years ago now. What is up with that? I think that's odd. I think it's odd to have such a location-based memory. But, you know, I'm giving Becca all my other damage. Why not give her that, too? Location memory. That's so hard when you have that. And she's been bounced around from foster home to foster home. And so she has spots all over the town of Esker that are important or meaningful. Let's put it that way. They mean something to her. Here's a spot where this happened. Here's a spot where that happened. I don't know how other people don't have this. It's so ingrained in me that I don't know how people are just like, oh yeah, whatever. Like, do you really just forget all that? You don't have things attached to places? You don't go to places and there's your memory of, you know, you climbed up that one hill and Lex Luthor gave you directions? Like, Griffith Park, I haven't even been there in forever and it's covered with locational associations. Like literally I could take you to the spot where I was like climbing up this non-standard path, sort of ascending this side of the hill, and this shirtless bald boy was running by and I said, hey, how do I get to the and he stopped and he looked at me and he kind of laughed because I didn't know who he was, and I only realized it afterwards that it was Lex Luthor from Smallville. But he gave me directions, told me how to get there, and I was like, thanks, and he ran on by, you know. Like, how do you not get your head sunburned running around like that? Wear a hat. I'm sure he has hair now. But, like, that's a spot that I could take you to. right? That's a location-based memory, and almost all of my memories are highly location-based. I just think it's a either you I think maybe you either you are that way or you aren't. I don't think you can induce it, but it's there, boy. I can't get rid of it. So why not give that to poor Becca? So I never really gave you the plot to Whispering Mountain. It kind of doesn't matter because I'm not talking about the plot. The plot is this boy, I'm not sure how old he is, like maybe early teens, maybe like 13, 14, maybe 12. I don't know. Doesn't say. He's living with his grandfather who does not like him, his grumpy old grandfather who runs a museum. And he goes to this school and the boys don't like him because he's not from there. Even though his grandfather lives there, his father's from there, whatever. It begins with him getting jumped, like I said, getting jumped by those boys after school who are going to beat him up because he's not from there, which is like, yeah, that's okay. And instead, he gets interrupted by, it's a horse-drawn home that Erebus and her father live in. And they come down the hill, they stop, they see what's going on, and the hawk jumps out and flies down and chases the boys off Owen, okay? So they rescue Owen from the boys, and they take him home. And he says, oh, I'm sure you can stay here. And his grandfather, who is a crabby old man, says, get out of here. I don't want to have any vagrants and vagabonds on my doorstep. So he's very rude to Owen's friends who he used to live with. He traveled with them before in the camper. I want to call it a camper. This is not modern, okay? There's no electricity. There's nothing. So it's not a camper, but it's like a camper. And so the grandfather's very rude to them and sends them away. And Owen goes in and the grandfather's like, I have to go to this meeting. You stay home. You're in trouble. Why are you an hour late? And he's like, well, I got beat up by, he's like, no. And so he makes him stay home. No supper. It's like disgusting supper. He doesn't eat it. And guard the museum because they have this harp that everybody's after. They found this old harp. The grandfather found it in the old monastery. It's ancient, it's gold, it's worth a fortune. Everybody wants the harp. So the whole book is about this harp thing, this thing that everyone's after, the MacGuffin of the book. So he stays home and guards the harp, and the grandfather goes to the meeting where he gets drugged, and they take the key away from him, and they come to the museum and steal the harp. But Owen tries to stop them and gets beat up, of course. He's always getting beat up in the beginning of this. And they break his glasses, so he can't see a thing. And they take him along, and they put the blame for taking the harp on him. See, they make it so it looks like he stole it and ran away, so that, you know, the trail isn't leading to him, to them. So they take him along, they make him write letters saying, you know, ransoming the harp to all these different people, including the Prince of Wales, Lord Malin up the mountain, and whoever else, like, I don't know. And give me 1,000 whatevers, and I'll give it back. And so he writes these letters using his worst spelling, which is very funny to read. Also, he can't see because he doesn't have the glasses. And then they leave him in this house where it's going to tumble down and kill him. Because they keep almost, they're like, we're going to kill you now. And then they don't do it, which is like horrifying, but also kind of funny. And then they're like, no, let's just leave him here. It'll look like he got killed in a landslide. It's fine. And so the whole book is he's trying to get this harp back to his grandfather, and he's trying to make sure his grandfather knows he didn't steal it. And he has to go all over the place. And he's already been dragged, 40 miles to this hillside. And then beyond it is where Erebus and her father are camped out. So he gets to them because he sings the song through his nose and the hawk comes and rescues him and brings Erebus, and she cuts him down where he's all tied up and hogtied to this chicken coop thing. It's so visual and so viscerally landscape-based. Man, I love this book. Because you're there with them, and they are here, and they have to go there. How can I say that better? You are in one place, because that's the thing about a landscape, right? You have to go to the other place. You can't just be, like, hanging out here. It's directional. It's directionally based. I am recovering from a cold or else a lot of dust that I breathed on Friday. I'm not sure which. Cannot breathe. Yes, so I was saying it's directionally based, and a directionally based story. This is why I say adventure. This is like the old definition of adventure. Going from one place to another. You gotta go somewhere. These are all those traveler's tales from the Middle Ages. Like, it goes way back. It's the Odyssey. You can't just be somewhere. You got to go somewhere. So I like the Odyssey better than the Iliad, for all that it has a lot of problems. But anyway, they're going somewhere and doing things. I probably shouldn't try to do this when I can't breathe, but I always can't breathe, so I don't know when I'm supposed to do it in that case. Sorry about the breathing, however. Wheeze. So Owen and Erebus. There's this whole subplot with these little people who live under the mountain who are sick and get Erebus because she and her father are sort of doctors. So they come and get Erebus to come treat them all because they're sick. And they are the original people who were the gold miners made the harp in the first place. See, it's all about the harp. It makes me want to write something that's object oriented, like one thing. I want a MacGuffin. I never do that. Never. There's a thing that everybody's after and everybody wants and is driving the whole story. And even these people who have been living under the mountain for 2,000 years, which is a long time to be under a mountain, and no wonder they're all kind of sick. Even these people are like, well, we got to get the harp back because that's our harp. We made it. It's our harp. It almost makes me want to write something into the Becca book that is some kind of object. Like, I mean, you know, I went to see the pie, but what if there's a thing? What if there's a thing that's, it's silly because like, they're just props, you know? But when you're obsessed as she is, it's not just a thing. It's so much more. And it all goes back to like the action figure thing I was talking about. These objects are imbued with meaning. I mean, every object is just an object, really, but it's imbued with meaning because we put meaning on it. And then some objects are full of meaning for some people, but not others. So I don't know. She could have like, there could be like a thing. I'm thinking about a thing now. I don't know what it would be. I have to think about it. Think. Anyway, developing this story has been really, really strange and weird. I wrote a ton of ideas, like developing ideas this week, and pushed it so much farther along than it ever was before. It's just very odd to me. I know you have to start with a small idea in order to get to a big idea. Like, I have to start with one thing and then add and grow and change and da-da-da-da. I don't come up with the full thing at the beginning. I have to figure it out as I go, and I have to decide what the story's going to be by trying to tell the story. And, like, I made a schedule, a weekly schedule for her, which really made things clear for me in my mind. Like, here's this class. You have a huge project due midnight Sunday every week. Oh, okay. That changes everything about how the rhythm of the story goes. She has assignments. People in regular life who are not in school don't have assignments. Do they? Not usually. There's a thing I need to do today, though. There's your work, and you do your work, and you have deadlines and this and that. But these guys, they have, and they all, everybody in this class, in these certain classes in this program, has the same schedule. They all have these big projects due Sunday night. And so, like, Becca, who knows about editing, is like, I'm going to get started early and get this done because everyone's going to be in there. And there's only like however many slots on these big computers with all the processing power and the using digital video. And you get done, and then it has to do this thing, which I've forgotten the word of. Is it compressing? I can't remember. It has to process somehow, and it takes a long time, and you can't rush it. It doesn't hurry up. Maybe it's faster now than it was back in whatever. It has to be. 2003. Was it 2002, 2003? Has to be faster now. But anyway, there was a process, and you can't rush it, and it takes time. And you can't rush editing. You can't rush any of this. You can't rush sound design. Like, you have to have the sounds right, or it looks like garbage. You don't buy it without the sounds being right. It'll kick you out immediately. And, like, the shooting part and all that is, like, she knows that because she's been doing it, even if it's been action figures. But you understand how to make the lighting look good and not like crap. It'll look like crap if you do it bad, and you have to do it right. And she understands about that and about like setting up shots and everything because of practicing with stupid little action figures. And you really can learn a lot just from doing that, just from like setting them up. Where do you want them? How many do you want? Where do you want them standing? How do you want them laid out? What's your angle? Are you looking over the shoulder of the one, looking over the shoulder of the other? What's behind them? Like, you can't not do that. You have to know that. And it has to be, there's just so much to it, which is why I don't do it anymore. It's too hard. And there's so much to it. And everything goes wrong all the time. And sound especially makes me crazy. Like, I gave that to her. Like, it makes her nuts. She's like, it's like having 10,000 crayons. You have too many. You have too many things. Everything contributes, and it's just this massive 10,000 piece puzzle you have to do all the time, and it's just so much. And if you don't know, then you're like, whatever, it's fine. But then you make garbage, and everyone who watches it is used to watching extremely talented people building these things and making them perfect. And then, so when you watch really amateurish stuff, you see how bad it is. Like, we're not forgiving with this kind of thing. So beginning filmmakers are just like up against it. They don't have the skills. They don't have the time. They don't have the team. They're just like, oh, I have to do the sound. I have to do the sound. What sounds do I use? Where's my, so you might have a library of sounds for layering in, but if you don't know how to do that, you don't know how to do it. So they all have to learn. Oh, it's so hard. So poor Becca, she's doing all that. But she luckily has the background where others have some, but they don't have that. So I don't know. Practicing really helps. Practicing, even if you're using action figures, really helps. I shot a whole movie with bunnies one time. Stuffed bunnies. He's sitting there lighting stuffed bunnies. I don't remember what it was even about, and I don't think I have it anymore, but I do remember running around, like, making the bunnies hop, 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 and then, like, you just see them, like, you can't see where I'm holding the back end of them, you just see the front of them as they move. Like, okay, what are we doing? You end up doing the most ludicrous things. There was a movie my students were shooting, and they got this grant, and they wanted this girl. Can't remember the plot of this movie, and I do have it on DVD, and I am in it, yes. Oh no. What was I playing? A mean mom? I was always playing the mean mom, or the person who, like, said no, and it ruined the person's life, because these are, you know, teen boys making movies. So we were out in a park. We were in Minto Brown Park in Salem, and the girl had to hang herself from a tree. So she had a harness, and there was a rope, and they had a terrible time. They were trying to, like, lower her smoothly from the rope, and it wasn't working. And I was like, just move the camera instead. And they're like, oh, we don't have to do both. Anyway, I just remember I had to sew this girl into a dress at one point up the back because the zipper was busted. Like, in this bathroom, sewing a girl into a dress. Like, what am I doing with my life? Oh, it's so weird, the things you end up doing. We put Steve over the transom. In an office we were allowed to use, but they had forgotten to give us the key or leave it unlocked. We put Steve over the transom. Like, what's happening? Oh, I should watch those again one day. But guess what? I'm not gonna. Oh, I don't want to see baby me, for one thing. I think it would be kind of traumatizing. So you end up doing weird stuff. I get to give them all those fun things. It's very fun storytelling when you get to have people trying to tell a story. And you don't even have to know the story that they're telling to have them telling the story. Like, we don't have to see the movie. It's a book. You can't see the movie. But you do have to have a sense of what's going on. Like, there's a scene where Zeke runs into the river and dumps his father's ashes out of an urn. When she's like, wow, what'd you use for ashes? And he's like, ashes. And it's only later she finds out that was his actual father's actual ashes that he used, because the guy was a bastard and beat the hell out of him. So, like, you can see scenes without understanding them, which is very fun in fiction. You can see places without understanding what's happening. They do all these weird things, and it's all part of the process of, like, learning to make the movies. Anyway, it's all really fun to write for me, and I think it'll be fun to read, because there's just so much. There's so much. I've never written such overwhelmed people. They're all just, like, up to their eyeballs in work and doing impossible jobs like that. Like, I have to assemble a certain number of people and a sound person and a camera person and I have to direct it. Oh, but I have to be in it. So you have to shoot it. And, like, oh gosh, like, it's just so hard. It's hard. It makes me insane trying to do all that, but more power to these fictional people. So I don't know how landscape plays into that, but all I can think about when I'm reading The Whispering Mountain, which I'm reading now, is how to use landscape for a purpose. Like that, even that thing, well, Zeke's from Florida, but the thing about going in the river, like dumping ashes in the river. You don't want to go in that river. Do you know what goes into the river? Sewage. And I know it's treated first, but, like, I don't want to swim in treated sewage either. Ew, don't go in the river. But he goes in the river. Maybe he'll go in a, there's a smaller, anyway, you don't need to know where they're going in the river. It would be where my brother and I went kayaking. Up there, past Missy's house. Anyway, there's all these fun scenes. It's fun to write, but it has to be important. And I caught myself halfway through Becca and Cole, who's from a different book, talking, and I don't know where they are, and I don't know why we're there. And that's when I stopped because I was like, this is a landscape-based story. It has to be important where they are. And especially since we know the landscape from previous books, it has to matter where they are. It has to mean something. And I think that's actually something I need to think about a lot more in all writing. Like, where you are has to matter. Like, if you're downtown going to the bagel store, that's a thing that matters. It has to mean something. Everything can't just be like, oh, I don't know, we're going over there, which it tends to be when you're writing a draft. Like, I don't know, they go to the cafeteria. These people are always in the cafeteria in this book. I think it has to be richer in terms of locations, which it seems to be a problem I'm having lately. It was definitely a problem with Summerlands. It has to be richer in locations. It has to be richer in meaningful locations. Even just rereading The Nerve lately, I was like, this is so much more vivid. Like all the places they went to that Chinese restaurant where Winston knew all the guys and they were joking with him. And like they went out for dinner. It was just going out to dinner, but you can't make it just going out to dinner. It has to have like three things going on at all times. And that did. It really did. It had that going out to dinnerness, and it had him knowing these guys and these guys teasing him, and it had her seeing this interview that she just did up on the TV in the restaurant. Like, that was a bunch of stuff going on. And that's just so important for writing that nothing can just do one thing. Make it do it. I think that's a good rule. Isn't that a good rule? Rule of three. Which reminds me, I also want to talk about Lloyd Alexander's Prydain. Is that how you say it? Prydain? Prydain Chronicles, which are also the most landscape-based writing ever. Like, those and A Cluster of Separate Sparks and The Whispering Mountain. Landscape, landscape. It's so important to everything. Like there's marshes, Tolkien too, I guess. I didn't mean that dismissively. It just looks like, oh yeah, I forgot a really large, really obvious one. There's the marshes and there's the lakes and there's all these things. There's the mirror that somebody stomps on so he can't see. There's like, and he's after his identity the whole time. Man, those are good books. I should read them again. Anyway, I think the rule that every location has to do three things is important. I think that's really important. And the fact that my scene went dead on me because I didn't know where they were or what they were doing, I just had Cole taking her around to see the different buildings. But like, I don't know what's new there since I was there last. I haven't been there. Oh no. But there's new buildings. I think they built a new soundstage, or possibly two. Like, this place is booming. They are doing stuff. There's a lot going on. There's this building for CGI. There's people over there on their computers doing stuff. Like, there's effects. There's just a lot going on. It's not the little place it used to be, which is good, right? And I don't know what to do with my characters I haven't seen in 5 years. What have they been up to? Like, what's Cole been up to? Cole was on a trajectory. I wonder what happened. But she's new to Becca, so, but then Becca's weirdly obsessive about this show and knows everything about everybody because she even says at one point, she's like, well, I'm not a stalker. It was on her Wikipedia. Like, oh no. Oh no. That's kind of stalkery to look up someone's Wikipedia, isn't it? Isn't it? Before you've met them? I don't know, but she's obsessed. That's what you do. All right, landscape. Make it mean something. Go from place to place for a purpose. When am I going to get Becca and Shay to go to that old location where the campers were? Are the campers still there? Surely not. Surely they cleared them out, but who knows? Like, if it's all overgrown, Thrushcross is huge. Who knows what's where? That's how they were able to live there without anybody knowing. They would just, like, if you don't drive through all the time, like, all you have to do is put a chain across some posts and nobody's going to go down that road. They'll assume there's a reason for it to be there, and if nobody who owns the place goes around, and the people who own the place didn't have a car. Remember her parents who owned the place? They didn't have a car. They walked to work. They walked to work and they walked home, and they didn't really even buy groceries. They just like lived off leftover canapes. They were so close to the bone all the time. So it's not like they were driving around the North End seeing whether people were coming and going on bikes. So the landscape, it has to matter. It really does. And I think the best writing is writing, obviously. Everybody knows this, that you can see and feel and smell and taste, and you feel it in your bones, and you know the place like you would know it if you were there. Like, it's so vivid. And you don't have vivid writing if you're not doing all those things. And I'm just feeling really adamant about this. That's why I went and read that book, The Whispering Mountain, because I'm like, I want it to be like this. I want it to be good like this. I want it to be a location that matters like this. I want it to be a location that's so clear and vivid. And you know, and imagine having that 40-mile distance when people have to go by foot or by horse or by, you know, their cart or whatever they're in. Like, or Erebus, who goes on miniature camels under the ground. Like, it's far, and I wonder why I ride it so far. But you have to have obstacles, so that's good. A landscape can give you really good obstacles. I think that river in Thrushcross was a really good obstacle. Like, it splits the town in half, and it splits the property, so the one side is sort of separate from the other. So the uncle side is separate from the house side. Okay, yes, I like the way I wrote a thing. All right, I don't know what else to say about it, except I really believe strongly landscapes are crucial. For things that I like, a landscape has to be important, and they have to go somewhere for a purpose. Oh no, it's really hugely important. I just didn't really think about it before, until yesterday when my scene went dead on me. So, gotta rewrite that. It's cool. We love, she has a VW bus with daisies on it. She knitted that afghan that I'm making one of, because it's like hers that I made up. All right, I have to go do other things. I've got bread rising, so I'm going to go do that. And I'm going to try to get out in the landscape more often, which I never do. And that's what I'm going to do, and I hope you're doing okay. Send me an email at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com. Tell me what you're reading. Tell me what you're writing. Tell me about landscapes. I really think landscapes are huge in books. Just so important. Yeah. And there's plenty of books that don't really have important landscapes, but those aren't the ones I like, are they? All right. So send me those because I want to know. And keep an eye on the sacred cheese of life. Bye.